Hello, Toronto. I'm Stevie San from the Heartistic Podcast. Before you start the show, I'd like to give you a little disclaimer of my own. The conversations in this podcast are hard-driven and passionate. Some opinions, language, and suggestions may not be tolerated by some listeners. Thanks for listening, and viewer's discretion is advised.
At heart's wake, in the mind's eye, we invent the escape to our fantasies. Visions, dreams, and desires, we create our realities, burning through your soul, your heartbeat's passion. We are...
Hello and welcome again to another episode of the Heartistic Podcast. I'm your host, Stevie Sound, and this is where we get to dive into the hearts of creators and heart-driven individuals around the city of Toronto. I'm actually ecstatic that so many people are taking a liking to this podcast. Advocacy and information is the best way to reveal someone's desires and passions and to help those passions and desires help accommodate our world or communities. Creativity is a tool that has inspired many and has ultimately created some of the best working tools and services to assist in life's hardships. Why most people tend to stay low in their spirits beats me. Life is hard and emotions suck, don't get me wrong, but I think it's influence that has been the biggest time stopper or infraction that seems to keep us down. So before I delve deeper into influence, I'm going to thank everyone who has listened and who has kept this belief in me that creativity inspired is the dagger to all those thoughts of failure. Influence can be good, as we can see. I was influenced to help spread awareness, and I'm happy to see it come to life. I've had several friends call me and just love the idea of the show and express to me how it has raised them to reopen projects, to elevate their current projects and companies to higher levels. This is exactly why I started the Heartistic Podcast. So again, from the bottom of my wilting heart, I love you, and I'm greatly thankful for all of you. Influence, good or bad? Both. Literally both. It depends on how you handle the temptations. The taste that temptation can leave in our lives is a poignant one, either for success or failure. As artists and creators, that influence is as real as the art you're producing. It can fling you into the wildest drive of your life, or it can be the shovel that fills in your grave, literally. Being an artist, you are influenced by like-minded creators, people's opinions, sporadic decisions, and evidently, substances. Substance abuse has been part of the music industry since the beginning. It's one's release, one's way to find a new idea, but ultimately it's been an obstacle. It's something that you don't need, but it's something that doesn't always reveal itself as the Reaper, so to say. So I can understand why influence and sometimes substance abuse could actually be a healer. I know that sounds backwards, but it did happen to me. I used substances for a long time. I was convinced that the use of them would better my craft and expand my mind more. However, in reality, I wasn't doing that. I was creating, and albeit I was heading forward, I thought, keeping control on things. But the damage that the influences create are not always instant. They revealed themselves as problems over time. I was creating, moving forward, but my name wasn't. I was going forward as an addict. Even though I knew I was not an addict, people were not taking me seriously. I was declining in health, not critically, but I was critically killing my soul and my ambition. Today, I welcome a man that can relate to similar accounts in his own life. The show alone won't directly dive into his stories and problems, but we will be journeying through some of his experiences while being active in the industry for 30 years. His name is Bill Bell, and I've had the wonderful opportunity to work with this fine, hardworking gentleman while I was recording with a couple of bands. The degree of professionalism and willingness to adapt to the setting of your passion is his strong suit. Bill Bell is an engineer, multi-instrumentalist, creator, father, and advocate that has been contributing to Canada's musical lifestyle for over 30 years of his life. He is a friend and musical partner of local Toronto icon Tom Cochran for over 25 years. He has produced and played with some ever-inspiring names such as Jason Mraz, Justin Ozuka, Jimmy Rankin, Danko Jones, and Alex Leeson from the band Rush. Everyone, would you please give a warm welcome to the talented, hardworking, inspiring Bill Bell.
Thank you again, Bill, for coming on to the show. Let me ask you, this might be a little hard for you to dig up because you've probably gone through so much, but what was, if there is, the single most aspiring moment in your life that has started this attraction into music and evidently pushed you 30 years into your life?
I mean, that's, you know, inspiration comes at different times in your life, but I mean, the thing that got me into music when I was a kid was, you know, basically being a fan of Led Zeppelin and
Absolutely. The 70s was very revolutionary, even for a person like me that was born in 1989. Majority of my playlist is in the 70s. You know, the music just resonated.
Yeah, and so imagine being alive and that stuff is on the radio, and you know, and I'm riding my bike and there's no social media, and so the only thing that exists is that fantasy in your mind. And I had the rock posters of guitar players in my room, and I'd sleep with my guitar, and you know, and I had that dream, and I didn't have all the information that people have now of making it or not making it, or you know, and I think that information is great, but in a way. I lived in such a vacuum that I could live in my fantasy world and just work towards making that happen without any diversion.
Yeah, you know, I love, because music's so vast now to make, like the whole digital aspect of it, you think that there isn't, you know, I can spend so much time and do this, I have all the equipment here, but no, there are a lot of distractions, and it's really great that you brought that up. What about one value you've held on to near and dear? And how has that value basically helped you elevate in your music?
Well, I mean, a value is just basically don't be a dick. Like, be a good person, you know? Because,
yeah.
I mean, that just carries you through all walks of life. Because, I mean, so many musicians, when they realize that they're good, their self-worth is all around their instrument, and they create this mask and this ego shield around themselves. And you know, I mean, you're a good person, and so, I mean, it's so much more than that, because, you know, if music does fall away, that was great advice one time a producer gave me, because I was married, and I was 35,
mm-hmm.
or 34, 35, and I hadn't had a child yet, but I was married, and so I worked with this producer in Los Angeles, and he's a really older, well-known producer. And he goes, so you're married, and he's a family man. He said, why don't you have kids? And I said, well, I'm just waiting, you know, till I can get my career off the ground, which, because I didn't have a ton of money. And the advice that he gave me was that family and love will always be there for you, but your career is fleeting.
Hmm.
You know, and so with your music career, you can have a lot of success, but, I mean, if you don't have anybody to share it with, then it really is meaningless.
It's really cool that you speak like this, because that's actually how I kind of felt when I first did music with you, with my band Dear Society. You know, of course, we went through so many people. I went through so many bands. And then I actually, the first time we were working with a professional, Bill Bell.
Right.
And the music was so powerful and meaningful to me. And when I saw you work with us, you basically like conformed and transformed into us for a day, so you could fully get the understanding of what we expected, that's exactly where inspiration started flowing from me and being like, okay, you know, you have to focus and take time. And like, Bill obviously loves what he's doing. He obviously just doesn't see us as kids. He sees this as, you know, something more. And that's exactly that's exactly what it was for us. I truly now see how the industry is actually so much better with teamwork and, you know, with focus.
Well, thank you for saying that. And you know what it is, I think, is just experience. Is that, you know, I've been doing this for 40 years,
mm-hmm.
for 35 years professionally. And so, you know, when you look at that history of years, you know, I could either get really down on myself for you know, again, like having all that time in and maybe not having achieved, you know, the huge house in the hills or whatever you want. But
mm-hmm.
like I said, when I was a kid, that was never really my dream anyway. I mean, I wasn't thinking about the business. I was thinking about music and the love of music. And so thank you for saying that when I came in. I conformed to you guys because
mm-hmm.
as a producer, there's some producers that bring their own footprint into the music, and you hire a producer for that. Like, you want his sound on it. And I've always kind of prided myself on being a silent member of the band, where I really come into whatever project I'm working at and really just try and bring the best out of the band or the artist, and really try not to bring my personal footprint too much into it, unless, of course, the artist asks me to. But just to really kind of push you guys to make the best recording you can. And where the experience comes in is that when you hear, you know, you were playing bass and you did a great job, but there's still things that you were doing that I was pushing you on to be better.
Absolutely.
And in your mind at the time, you may have thought, man, he's really pushing me. Like, I think this is really good right now, but he's pushing me to do better. because my experience tells me that what your good, what your level of good is, wasn't good enough for what we were trying to achieve. And so that just pushes you to always be better.
Yeah, well, absolutely. That time after that day, I looked at the lead singer and I was like, oh boy, what am I going to do? And then probably about 3 months later, we had a rehearsal in Lynx. And after the rehearsal, you came up to me and you were like, what the hell, man? That was awesome. Like, nearly couldn't play and now you played it so great. So that was a big moment in my life for me being like, hey man, someone that now you're starting to look up to is actually acknowledging you because you took that 3 months. I didn't stop playing. My fingers were, I did not stop playing. I was like, oh no, I need to be in this band. And so it was a really big push for me. Thank you.
But you did the work, so you should be proud of yourself. Because I mean, a lot of people and I've had this in the past with some bands I've been working in, say the bass player develops an attitude and it's like, well, fuck Bill, man. Like, what does he know? Like, you know, I think what I'm doing is great, and they don't want to do the work.
Yeah, see, it was the way that you came. Like I said, you conformed and transformed into us. It was the way that you came and said, here, man, I'm not here to throw my style on you. I want to help you. I want to feel your style, and I want to see what I can contribute to it. So that was amazing. Yeah. What are three must-haves in a creative process or when you're about to, you know, produce or engineer an album? What are three things that you have to have around you or three things that need to be in place while you're in your creative process?
Well, I mean, the song has to be there. I mean, that's number one. I mean, there has to be a good song.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that comes with the lyric and the message. And then you have to have someone deliver that song. Because there are lots of instances where say there's songwriters and but they don't have the voice to push it, and then they might give it to someone like Adele,
mm-hmm.
and then she records it and her voice matched with this great song. It's just a great good song. And then and you're talking about the studio, and are you talking about the studio environment or before you get to the studio?
Well, the question's usually
because
just
if you're talking about the studio environment, then obviously you need a fairly decent recording room to record in, because you know if you have this great song and this great band and you go in and you try to record it on your iPhone,
mm-hmm.
you know it's not going to sound very good. And so equipment is necessary, and the better the equipment, the better chances that you have of getting a better recording.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah. See, this question is more for kind of like I ask this question to a lot of my interviewees, and it's more kind of for the creative person that's creating the song, but I asked you because you'd get answers like that for an engineer. You know, a lot of people that are like, oh, we have this mic, but if you really want that crisp, clean, powerful movement song, you're right, you need the equipment. And you know, places like Long McQuaid have made that so easy for you to actually go and rent at a great price.
Yeah, and when I was first starting, again, because I wanted to make such great recordings, but I didn't have the funds to do it, and so I would convince myself that some inexpensive piece of gear that I bought, that the advertisement told me that it sounded like the expensive piece of gear that I couldn't afford, and so I was using this cheap gear and really believing the advertisement, and but then going, why are my recordings sounding the same? And then eventually, you know, when I moved to LA and I was up around these big studios and everybody was using Neve preamps or API and mm-hmm. 1176 compressors and 2A compressors and all classic gear that's been around since the 60s and 70s, you know, 50s even. And all of a sudden I started using that equipment, which is a little more expensive, but I just basically sold all of my cheap shit and bought one good thing.
Yeah.
You know, and when you start using that classic gear, you plug it in and you play through it and you go, oh, okay, there it is. Like, I don't have to do anything. But it, again, if you're putting good into it, good's going to come out of it, you know?
Absolutely.
If you put shit into it, you know, this is the kind of pig theory, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I always say you must invest to get something out of it. Invest to get what you want. Money can go so far, and it can go even farther when you put it into yourself.
Yeah, and so it's one of those, and again, like, I look at home recording, and I think during the quarantine, home recording equipment has sold out. Like, it's really hard to get, and I love that, because there's a lot of artists making really interesting recordings at home, but then I hope that there's some artists as well that don't beat themselves up too bad and realize that even though you just invested all this money, sometimes to book time into a really good recording studio with a Neve console and great microphones and a, you know, it might cost you $100 or $150 an hour to do it, But as you know, if you do your pre-production and your rehearsal, then you go in with a band, you could knock out, you know, two songs in 2 hours if you're good enough. And so that's really a great investment on your project. And then you get all, this great, incredible gear, and usually with a pretty good engineer.
Yeah, absolutely. That's great advice. At the beginning of this episode, I went on a rant a little bit about substance abuse and like the influence of substance and the influence that you get into the industry. It's great to go into this question right now because we're basically talking about all the positive things that you can do to maintain your drive into your craft. But there are, you know, these obstacles that sometimes you don't think of them as bad. You know, you don't see them as an obstacle, but that's exactly right. What they are. We can see that many people have been affected by them or have sadly, you know, succumbed to it. I really do believe in the power of advocacy, and I do believe that one person's story can be another person's ticket out. And I do understand that you have some experience with this. Would you care to brush up maybe on the lifestyle of touring and working as a musician for 30 years, the ups and downs and the influences of the industries?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I grew up much like a lot of people with an abusive father.
Okay.
And then a mother who, back in the 70s, Valium was prescribed. And so she had a hard time with my father as well. So she medicated through it. So my mother was kind of non-existent growing up. And, you know, and so I had a fairly tough childhood, but my mood was always optimistic. I've always been an optimistic person. And so I grew up dismissing my upbringing and not really thinking about it too much. And so what happened then when I got into music was at the beginning of my music career, I was very diligent. I didn't drink. I didn't do any drugs at all up until I was maybe 25.
Okay.
I did when I was a kid. I mean, when I was, God, I was, did tons of drugs and drank, and I got arrested when I was 14 and had to go to court. And I knew that I wanted to be in music, and so at least I had the whereabouts to be like, okay, I'm living in a not great neighborhood. All my friends are going to jail for crimes and getting arrested with drugs and dealers and a certain agent. And I was 14 at the time, and so I don't recommend this, but I had to survive the situation, and so I quit high school at 16.
Mm-hmm.
And had an opportunity to join a band, and so I joined a cover band and was playing in Northern Ontario with these crappy bars, literally making $50 a week and starving. But I thought, my perception was, oh my God, I've made it. Like, I'm making a living making music. And I remember coming home, and I moved out of my mom's place as well, so I was 16 on my own. And my mom had to sign a letter with the Liquor Control Board of Ontario so that I could play in bars underage. I remember coming home and being so thin because I at $50 a week, I wasn't eating much, obviously. And,
right.
But I was still so happy that I was doing it. And so, like I said, then after my troubled younger teen years, I just dedicated myself to music, didn't do any drugs or anything until I was 25. Unfortunately, my brother passed away from a drug overdose around that time. And I started going down a bit of a bad path and got back into drinking and drugs again. And but then I was so focused on music that music was my savior at everything. Like, I never went too far down the rabbit hole with substance abuse,
right,
to ever jeopardize my music.
Awesome.
And then so I basically started playing, and then eventually when I reached the goal that I wanted to do, so now I'm playing with Tom Cochran, who's a well-known Canadian artist.
Mm-hmm.
and I'm playing arenas with him in the mid-90s, and we're back doing drugs and drinking. And And then, you know, unfortunately, you know, I lost my meter on self-control a little bit. And I went I fell into the rock star trap where, okay, let's see how much we can drink and go on stage now. But at the time, it just seemed like such a party. But then what happens is you start disrespecting your dream, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And thankfully, I mean, I still kept it together, and I moved to Los Angeles, and I started playing with Jason Mraz. But there's times when I'd be on stage with Jason, and we're playing in, you know, these huge concerts in England for 20,000 people, and I'm looking at the set list going, okay, great, four more songs till we're done, and I can get into that bottle of tequila backstage and get the party going.
Yeah, and that becomes the problem, right?
You know, and all of a sudden you're like, what am I doing? Like, my 15-year-old self would kick my ass right now for disrespecting the gifts and everything that I've got, but that's what addiction does to you. And chasing sex during all this time, and you know, and all this time wasted where, you know, where you should be putting it back into your career and making phone calls and connecting with people and practicing and learning. But all of a sudden, you know, addiction kind of takes that away from you and takes that drive away. And all of a sudden, you're like, man, I'm having so much fun, though. This is awesome. And, until years go by and you don't grow anymore inside of addiction.
So are there any organizations here in Toronto that assist with artists and people in the industry that have been greatly affected by substance abuse?
Absolutely. And so when I moved away from Los Angeles, and my daughter really saved my life in a lot of ways.
Awesome.
Because, when she was born in 2001, I never let myself get too out of control, because all of a sudden you're responsible for another human being, even though I would still party, but not as crazy as when I was younger. So when we're living, I was a single father with her in Los Angeles, and I was touring with Mraz, and I had nannies to look after her, and it was just really intense. And so she was entering high school, and she was having a rough time, and so we moved back to Toronto so that she could finish high school. But then I moved away from my dream, which was Los Angeles, and my career. But I did that happily, because, I mean, you do that for your child.
Absolutely.
But all of a sudden, I didn't realize that I fell into a depression coming back to Toronto. And started drinking more, but then not drinking with friends anymore. Like, I'd go to parties and I'd be like, okay, well, see everybody, and I'd go home and drink a bottle of wine by myself.
Yeah.
Like, I'd get into that destructive kind of pattern. And then my daughter called it, and she was really worried about me, because she just saw me dragging myself down and getting sad and waking up late and all that sort of thing. But another thing about me is I was never like an aggressive drunk.
Right.
I was always being optimistic, and so a lot of people never caught my addiction because I was just always in a good mood about it. But my daughter, living with me, she called me on it, and so because of her, I quit.
Amazing.
And after 6 months of being sober, I had a nervous breakdown because I realized that my addiction and my partying was allowing me to not deal with any of my childhood issues that were going on. And so all of a sudden, all this abuse that I had as a child was overwhelming that I hadn't dealt with my entire life. And I had a nervous breakdown, and I reached out to a really good friend of mine, and he recommended Unison, which is a free service for all Canadian musicians and people in the music community. So for road managers, crew, everybody, but you have to be professional, I think, for a year or something like that. You have to,
okay,
you know, make a living from music. So anyway, which I have. And so I called them, and within 2 days, they had me in free therapy, which was incredible. And I've been in therapy once or twice in my life, but I didn't really want it. And this time, I needed it. So it really saved my life. And now I do a lot of work for Unison to try and raise awareness and to try and raise funds for them. And So it's called the Unison Benevolent Fund, and if you Google it, and if you just call and sign up, it's 100% secure in the sense that nobody will ever know that you've registered. It's completely private.
That's amazing.
They have free financial assistance. They'll help pay your rent. They'll help provide groceries, free dental, and free therapy, which is what I asked them for.
This sounds like every musician should actually know about this Unison Benevolent Fund, is it?
Yeah, Unison, UNISON Benevolent Fund.
Perfect. I'll have some links or some more information on the website at artisticpodcast.com.
And again, it's 100% free. And again, they don't hustle you. There's no gain to this. Like, it's funded by other musicians and people in the music community, and it's 100% music friendly.
Perfect. Well, I thank you for sharing that story, because I do feel like, you know, we could all learn something from that. Moving on, I would like to ask you, are there any current artists that are making an impact on your life right now?
Oh, God, I mean, there's so many. My girlfriend, we live together, and her daughter is living with us because of COVID, and she's 26, and so she's introduced me to all this great music that I've never heard before. And,
amazing.
There's one female act from Sweden called First Aid Kit.
Okay.
And I think they're amazing. And again, it's kind of like a 70s folk kind of act, but you know, I so much great music. And again, I mean, you know, I love the rock music that you guys are doing, and that's right up my alley. And I wish I can get more interesting rock music, because that's one genre that I felt hasn't really. And I'm sure I've missed the boat completely. I'm sure it's out there, but I just haven't found anything that's really like Rage Against the Machine, like really blown me away at that level.
Absolutely. There is a couple of bands, one from LA, I think, called Fever 333, which is really bringing back up a kind of ragey thing. Again, my band, you know, we're going to be putting some more stuff out. And then I'm also working on another project, which is kind of like a rock rap.
Yeah, I love your music. I thought you guys were great.
Awesome. Thank you so much. Yeah. So that's going to be very... Toronto's gone a little bit to the indie side, but there's some great, like, I don't know if you've heard of the Mono Whales. They're coming out with a great sound right now. Yeah. Wax Limbs as well, too. Just Toronto is filled. Would you like to spread...
There's a Toronto band I love called Wild Rivers.
Wild Rivers. I don't think I've ever heard about that. I will definitely check them out.
Again, they're a bit of a folky act, but I love that singer-songwriter vibe. So.
Absolutely, definitely. Would you like to spread any word of inspiration or a crucial statement that you believe every growing creative should hear?
Yeah, don't beat yourself up too much.
Good life.
And really celebrate your individuality, because when I grew up as a session musician, I wanted to be a session musician. Mm-hmm. And so doing that, I became a little bit too much of a people pleaser as a musician, where I learned how to play like Stevie Ray Vaughan, and I learned how to play like David Gilmour, and I learned how to play like Jimmy Page, and I learned how to play like Eric Clapton, but just a little bit, like you know, learn their little flavors. So
yes.
That when I was in the studio and somebody asked for that, that I pulled that out of my bag of tricks. But what I didn't do in the beginning, which I have done in the last bunch of years, is develop my own sound. Because that takes a lot of courage to do that, because you have somebody maybe like the Sex Pistols, a band where they were so influential at the end of the 70s and beginning of the 80s, but all my musician friends were like, those guys fucking suck, like they can't even play their instruments. But at the end of the day, that doesn't matter, because their personality and what they knew how to do shone through so heavily.
Absolutely.
That they just kicked everybody else's ass as far as music. Or look at Nirvana, the same thing. When Nirvana came out, they kicked every rock band's ass, even though they weren't as efficient on their instruments.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's really about being true to you on your instrument. To me, it doesn't matter how good you are.
It's like the Misfits for me. I listen to the lyrics and it's kind of like, okay, I wouldn't see myself fully screaming these lyrics out, but the music is just so captivating that you're just like, yeah, I do want your skull. You know what I mean?
and again, for me, perfect is boring. And a lot of times, you know, when you get into the studio, everything's under a microscope and people try and make things perfect. And, that beats a little out there, but then you're missing the human element. And the human element is fucked up and it's raw and there's mistakes. And that's what people want. Like, they want to feel like they're on the ride with you.
Absolutely. Well, this brings me towards the end of the show, Bill. I do like to do a couple of things. We kind of did do the first game. The first game is just like a little plug-out game. I let you plug out anything that you want, which we've kind of already done. Is there anything else that you'd like to plug? Any?
Nope.
Nope? Good? Okay.
Nope.
Now, the second one, I hope we can do this one. Do you have a music library on your cell phone? Do you like listen to music via your cell phone, Spotify, or anything?
Yeah.
Okay. So the second game is called the playlist game. And what I basically do is I tell you to shuffle your library list and you tell me the first three songs and we kind of find out, you know, who you are musically.
All right, well, let me check out my playlist here.
Perfect. Awesome.
Going to my playlist.
And press that shuffle.
All right. Nathaniel Ratcliffe and the Night Sweats, called You Worry Me.
Okay, I've heard Nathaniel Ratcliffe and that album. That album's really good, the one that song's
on. And so that's cool. Southern Man came up by Neil Young and Crazy Horse.
Oh, perfect. And the third one was?
Wichita Lineman by Glenn Campbell.
So give me a comparability to these songs. What do they mean to you? Why are they on your list?
Well, I mean, You Worry Me is, God, it's such a great feeling song. I'm trying to remember the lyric right now. Gonna leave it all out there to dry. It's great. And just this whole vibe in the recording, I love the whole thing. Southern Man, I mean, God, I mean, that song speaks to me, and it's racial conference that America are having.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I don't know if you know this, but Neil Young wrote Southern Man, and then Lynyrd Skynyrd wrote Sweet Home Alabama in retaliation to Southern Man.
No, I didn't. Oh, my goodness. That's crazy. Wow, really?
Yeah, so if you listen to Sweet Home Alabama, they go, I heard Mississippi Young sing about her, heard Neil put her down. I hope Mr. Young will remember. Southern Man don't need him around anyhow.
Okay. No, huh? That's crazy. I did not know that, but now I'm going to go listen to that because I do remember that line. That's, yeah, wow. Holy. Okay. That's cool. That's some history right there.
So hats off to Neil, our fellow Canadian, for speaking the truth.
Absolutely.
And then Wichita Lineman is a great song by Jimmy Webb that Glenn Campbell covered. And if there's any guitar players out there, and even if you're, well, I don't know about Glenn Campbell, but Google Glenn Campbell, and that dude can play guitar.
Okay, well,
and,
you heard it.
You know, and just an incredible career. He was part of a studio band called The Wrecking Crew, which there's a great documentary on that you can watch. And they played on Beach Boys records and Sonny and Cher and The Monkees and you know, all these amazing hit records in the 60s. They were a Los Angeles session band called The Wrecking Crew.
Called The Wrecking Crew. What's the documentary called?
Wrecking Crew.
Oh, The Wrecking Crew. Okay, perfect. Awesome. Yeah.
It's an incredible music documentary.
Absolutely. I will definitely check that out. That's great. Well, Bill, once again, I would like to thank you for joining us towards helping inspire the creative community and youth of Canada and Toronto and anyone listening. Let's end off the show the way we always do.
Well, thank you very much for having me. And I guess now, after speaking to you, I'm Heartistic.
Yeah.
Bill here, over and out.
Thank you. Well, you always were, but now you're officially Heartistic. Thanks, Bill.
Exactly. Thank you so much for having me.
Spill your hearts out, Toronto, and stay Heartistic.